This is part two in the series on the oral law. Okay, yesterday we talked about that part of the oral law which came from God to Moses and to the people. And one moral of that discussion yesterday is that studying the written without the oral is intellectually incompetent. It's a little bit like this. Imagine a painting that's 4 feet by 4 feet, and then you take a square of cardboard that's 4 feet by 4 feet, and you cut holes of various sizes and shapes at random places in the cardboard, and then you put the cardboard over the picture. So all you can see is the part of the picture that is opposite the places where there are holes. And then you're asked to interpret the picture. I don't think you would accept that assignment. What you would say is, take off the cardboard so I can see the whole thing. Well, looking at the written without its setting in the oral is like looking at the picture with the cardboard covering most of it. It is intellectually incompetent to study the written without putting it into the setting, including the, at least the oral material that accompanied it. And I will mention that this is a favorite trick of Christian missionaries, to say to a Jew, you believe X, don't you? And he thinks, gosh, I guess I'm supposed to believe that. I think I heard it once when I was 16, you know. And then the Christian missionary says, well, it's not written anywhere. And then the Jew is terribly embarrassed, and he thinks, wow, did they put something over on me? Were they lying to me? Or, you know, when, of course, it doesn't have to be written anywhere. The fact that it's part of the tradition does not imply that it's written anywhere, or at least certainly not written in the five books of Moses or in the Bible as a whole. It can be part of the oral tradition, which, a portion of which, the core of which, originated at the same time and in the same way as the written. Now, I want to move on today to the other end of the spectrum, and that is rabbinic additions. And the first question is, where do the rabbis get the authority to add new mitzvos, brand new mitzvos, commandments that aren't there otherwise at all? Give me one of the blue books. You should take the blue books as well. I want to show you this inside. Page? 1027. It's verse 8, the middle of the page. If a matter of judgment is hidden from you, between blood and blood, between verdict and verdict, and plague, matters of dispute in your cities. So, you live in Tveria, and Reuben and Shimon are having a fight. Reuben says, Shimon owes me money. Shimon says, Reuben owes me money. Each has witnesses, documents, and there's no agreement in the authorities in Tveria how to settle the case. You shall rise up and ascend to the place that Hashem your God shall choose. You'll come to the Kohanim, the Levites, and to the judge, who will be in those days. You shall inquire, and they will tell you the word of judgment. This is like a Supreme Court. The local courts can't handle the question. So, you take it up to the High Court, and you inquire of them, and they tell you the word of the judgment. You shall do according to the word that they will tell you from that place that Hashem will choose. Now let's stop there. What was my problem? We're in Tveria and we can't get a settled judgment. We go to Yerushalayim, which is where it ends up in the end, Yerushalayim, and there's some supreme body of judges there, and we put the matter in front of them. They give us their judgment, the Torah says, to carry out their judgment. It seems to me that if the text ended here, end paragraph, go on to something else, Pesach, we wouldn't lose anything. It seems to me the whole story's over. Am I lacking any instructions here? Am I lacking any directions? Anything missing? Doesn't sound like it to me. Unless you see something that I don't see. The puzzle then is, why does the text go on? I stopped in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of a verse. Why does it keep going on? And look what it says in the middle of verse 10. And, in addition, and you shall be careful to do according to everything that they will teach you. According to the teaching that they will teach you and according to the judgment that they will say to you, shall you do. What's all that extra stuff? In American law, maybe this is true in other countries as well, you have a body called the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has very wide powers, even to the extent of striking down a law as being unconstitutional, but only when a case is brought before the court. Let's say the legislature of Ohio passes a law, and every member of the Supreme Court believes that it's unconstitutional. They can't do anything. They can't do anything. It may take years before a court is brought up through the legal system to the Supreme Court, a case is brought up before, through the legal system to the Supreme Court. Only then, when the case is brought before them, can they render a judgment. They are only a judicial body. If you thought that this institution being described in the Torah is only a judicial body, it can only settle cases brought before it, then the text should stop in after the first half of verse 10. When there's a matter of dispute, you come up, you ask them, they give you a judgment, and you carry it out. But it doesn't say that. It goes on to say, in addition to functioning of the Supreme Court, you shall be careful to do everything that they will teach you, according to teaching they will teach you, according to judgment they will tell you, shall you do. So clearly there are extra authorities here, above and beyond just settling difficult, outstanding cases. Now, the text is not very specific. It said there will be teaching and judgment. Teaching and judgment, above and beyond settling outstanding cases. What do those teaching and judgments include? Here, the oral tradition explains the specific content of the verse, but it's clear from the verse alone that this body is not just the Supreme Court. It has other responsibilities and other authorities. And the answer is that there are two elements here. One is interpreting, analyzing, and applying the laws that come from Moses. That's one responsibility that they have. And the other is creating new legislation. Those two powers are at least indicated here. Maimonides actually quotes this verse as the source for these powers. So if someone asks, where do the rabbis get their powers to make these new mitzvot? I'm just concentrating on that particular aspect of it, though both are included here. Both the power to make new mitzvot and the power to interpret and apply the old. The power to make new mitzvot, it's located in this verse. Are you with me? Yeah.
How do we know that? Couldn't those extra verses be emphasis? How do you know for sure that it's
included? How do we know that Shin Vav Lamed Ches Nun means table? Maybe it means airplane, or maybe it means bird, maybe it means idea. A text, this is a subject that requires perhaps a larger discussion, but I'll just tell you the in summary. If you push me, maybe I'll do more. A text is only meaningful as part of a culture. It requires a culture of people to use the text. And different texts are used in different ways. I can't remember if it was this year or the other year, I mentioned, you know, someone who complains about Shakespeare's plays that the events he describes didn't happen historically is missing the point. Shakespeare's plays are not history. If you think they are, you don't understand what the text is for. Now, if you think that clauses like this in a legal setting are there just for emphasis, then you have to go through all the legal portions of the five books of Moses and see that it isn't so. It isn't designed that way. There are poetical sections. In poetical sections, that would be a relevant thing to say. But this is not poetry. This is law. And in law, it doesn't work that way. Yeah.
The phrase from that place that Hashem will choose, I should assume that's referring to like the Beis HaMikdash.
Yes.
So what application does that have on the rest of the Pasuk?
Okay, I'll tell you, although I don't want to do everything that's in this verse. My point was only to show where the authority comes from. When the Sanhedrin has as its location the what's called the Chamber of Hewn Stones, picture the temple with its walls. At one spot, there's a chamber whose back wall is the wall of the temple, and then built out with three walls. That's where the Sanhedrin should sit. When that is the location of Sanhedrin, then they and other courts can try capital cases. When that is not their location, they can't try capital cases anymore. I'm not talking about they're sitting there at the moment, but that's not their location. Now, the Talmud tells us that as a result of Roman persecutions, they moved from place to place. They were in ten locations before the Sanhedrin ceased to function. During those positions, when there were other, and then other nine positions, no court anywhere could carry out a capital case.
So couldn't a denier of the oral law say something that this idea only applies when that function, when the Sanhedrin serves that function?
Wait a moment. We're not talking now about the oral law. We're talking about creating new legislation and interpreting old legislation. The existence of the oral law is an independent matter. Even if there were no Sanhedrin, there'd be an oral law.
I'm talking about somebody that wouldn't necessarily explain it using the oral law. We explain that idea that this applies, this means that the Sanhedrin is existing in that one place or a place that's given the same type of status.
Yeah.
But somebody that doesn't agree with the oral law, couldn't they say that a place that Hashem will choose, meaning that only when you're at the temple or the Kohanim are talking, that is in modern days, you couldn't then make new laws like this?
I think that that's on a par with saying, why couldn't someone say Shulchan means bird? Why couldn't he? Who's to stop him? Can't he just deny what everybody else says and say he means bird? Look, I will expand this a little bit if this is a serious question. A non-Jew came to Hillel and said, I want to convert on the condition that you teach me only the written. I don't want to learn the oral. I'm not interested. So Hillel said, okay, let's start with the alphabet, right? That's learning the letters. First day he taught him the first four letters, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet. Next day he came back, and Hillel said, before we go on to the next letters, let's review what we did yesterday. He pointed to an Aleph and said to the non-Jew, what's that? He says, Aleph. And Hillel says, no, that's a Dalet. He said, point to the Beis. Asked the non-Jew, what's that? He says, Beis. No, that's a Gimel. So the non-Jew said, I don't get it. Yesterday, I'm sure I didn't forget. Four letters. I'm sure I remembered that you told me differently. So Hillel says, oh, so you have to learn from me which the letters are? Then it's incompetent to ask for the explanation of the written without the oral. Hillel is making a deep philosophical point. What is a written text? A written text is smudges of ink on paper or on parchment. That's all it is. It's just decorative shapes. Maybe it's plans for, it's a diagram of a Japanese rock garden. Who knows what it is? A written text only has meaning as part of a culture that interprets it in a particular way. If you lose that, there are writings from ancient India which no one has been able to decipher to this day. Bitches don't know what they mean. It's definitely writing, but the culture is gone, and therefore we have no idea what the meaning is. So for a person to say, I have a culture, and a culture has this text, I've been using this text consistently in this way for as long as history is recorded. But maybe it means something entirely different. Well, then maybe this isn't an Aleph. Maybe Shulchan means bird. Maybe the names of God are really the names of the Greek gods. Once you do that, once you cut it free from the tradition, all you have is smudges on paper. Right? For it to have any meaning at all, it's got to be situated in a culture. So if you had disagreements at some time within the culture, then you could appeal to something. But if the culture has consistently understood it in one way, to suggest that maybe it means something else is to forget that the meaning of a text is only carried by the culture that uses it and interprets it. Okay, so now that's the first point, that they have the authority to do this. Now, that raises a fundamental question. What is the authority of those laws that the rabbis create? What kind of authority does it have? Intuitively, one might think, well, okay, maybe the the Torah from Moses gives them this authority to do it, but in the end, they created it. And isn't it true that rabbinic laws in general are much less stringent than laws that come from Moses? For example, if there's a conflict between a rabbinic law and a Mosaic law, almost always the Mosaic law wins. Or, let's say a law applies, and I'm not sure that I satisfied it. I did something, but now I have doubts whether I succeeded in fulfilling it or not. Well, if it's a Mosaic law, I have to go back and do it again. If it's a rabbinic law, I don't have to go back and do it again. Or, if you look at the penalties for violation, penalties for violating a Mosaic law are very heavy, and the penalties for violating a rabbinic law are typically much less. Doesn't that indicate that there's less weight to the rabbinic laws, less significance, less power? They have a lesser status. However, many, I would say the majority of authorities hold that the rabbinic laws are mosaically binding. They have the exact same authority as a Mosaic law. In spite of all of the details that I gave you, the conclusion that we would seem to be supporting is not correct. That really, they have the same authority as a law coming directly from Moses. So I want to explain to you, number one, how that's possible. And number two, if so, how is it that all those points of contrast don't indicate the opposite? How it's possible is not too difficult. Imagine there's a king, and the king appoints George to be the governor of your province. And George has in his office this royal proclamation from the king. George is the governor of the province, and what he says goes. And now George makes a rule that on Sundays you can't use umbrellas. It's not so fanciful. There is actually a town in North Dakota which used to have that as a law. No umbrellas on Sundays. And Philip goes on a Sunday with brazen disregard and opens up his umbrella. And they haul him into the police station, and he's charged with treason against the king. So Philip says, excuse me, the king? I'm 100% loyal to the king. It's this nut George, you know, who's the governor. He made this crazy law, and I did it despite him. That's true, I did it. I did it on purpose despite him. But I didn't have the king in mind, for sure not. What will the prosecutor say? George got his authority from the king. There's a royal proclamation that his laws are binding. Anybody who violates George's law is thereby violating his fealty, his loyalty to the king. Once the king gives George his authority, whatever the laws George issues have the stamp of the king on them. So, according to this position, the laws of the rabbis have God's authority behind them, and therefore the law of the rabbis has the exact same authority as the authority of putting on tefillin, or not eating pigs, or giving charity, or pursuing justice. If so, let me just finish the points, and we'll stop for discussion. If so, how could it be that the laws of the rabbis are uniformly, almost uniform, I should say, less stringent than those that come directly from Moses? If they have Moses' authority behind them, why aren't the rabbinic laws equal in that when there's a conflict, it should be a 50-50 standoff? Or when there's a question of whether I succeeded in doing it or not, I should be just as stringent in the rabbinic laws and have to do it over again rather than I'm being able to be satisfied with the doubt? Or the penalties, why shouldn't the penalties be equal? And the answer that's given is this, that the rabbis, when they wrote their laws, wrote them to be less stringent. They made them to be less stringent. So they wrote into the law, do X, but if you've tried to do X and you think you may have it, you're not sure, we don't require you to repeat it. That's good enough. And they wrote into the law, do X, but if doing X is going to conflict with a commandment coming directly from Moses, then we're not telling you to do X. Because they wrote that escape clause into the law itself. And they wrote, do X, but if you don't, then this is the penalty. And typically the penalty is much lighter than the penalty that the laws that come directly from Moses have. And one of the reasons they did that is not to confuse the two levels of law. The rabbis have the right to make new laws, but it is crucial that they should be kept distinct and they should be clearly identified. There are many cases when the rabbis make a law and there's a danger of confusing it with a law coming from Moses, and they will put weaknesses into the law just so it's clear that it isn't the standard Mosaic legislation, it's only rabbinic legislation. This was the mistake that Adam made. Adam made. God told Adam, don't eat from the tree. He told Chava, don't eat or touch the tree. And he didn't say the touching is my created extra fence around the law. No, he portrayed it as if it was God's law. And she said to the snake, God told us we can't eat from it or touch it, lest we die. Snake said, oh, really? So he pushed her against the tree, and she didn't die. And said, see that? The touching is clearly wrong, so the eating is also wrong. Had Adam told her, the touching I made up. It's true, God didn't say that. I made it up. I just made it up as a safeguard. Then the snake wouldn't have had that opening. But he didn't say that. Indeed, by the way, her argument, after all, is not so clever, because the threat that you'll die is a threat that you'll die for violating the law. Being pushed against the tree is not violating the law. That's an accident. So even if she'd eaten from it, it shouldn't have cost her life. So it wasn't a really very good excuse on her part. Okay, but at any rate, the point is that the rabbinic laws have to be clearly identified as rabbinic. There are verses in the Torah which say that the rabbis can't add to the Torah or subtract from it. The standard interpretation is they can't add new laws as if they came from Moses. That they can't do. But if they clearly identify the laws that they add, then it's perfectly all right. Question?
Said he got appointed by the king, and for instance, the documents that he was, but you know, it was really a forgery, and he was a mockery, etc.
Well,
because that's what the Reform movement says. We don't really believe in the rabbis; they weren't appointed by God, you know.
Well, let's not forget that there are people who don't believe in the Holocaust either. There's a certain point where a person says, "I don't believe it." It's not credible anymore. The fact that a person says, "I don't believe it," may just be a comment on his psychology that there's something wrong with his logic. And I would like to ask him, for what reason don't you believe it? Do you have any reason to? You have other texts from the same time say something different? Other traditions? What reason do you have for not believing it? Don't accept, it's an illicit move in logic, to accept all the burden of proof on yourself and leave the other guy free to make whatever ridiculous comments he wants. Right? He has to bear some of the burden of proof as well. When he makes a comment, I don't believe it, you should ask him, what positive reason do you have for rejecting it? At that point, I think the conversation will stop. There's certainly no positive reason for thinking that this isn't so. And as far as George is concerned, if you live in an ordinary state, it will never be an acceptable defense in court. Why didn't you carry out the court order? I thought it was forged. Why isn't that an acceptable defense in court?
Everybody would say it.
What's that?
Everybody would say that.
Because forged documents are very rare. Right, so if you have a proof that certain documents are forged, then it'd be interesting to hear. But if not, it's no defense to say I didn't believe the document because I thought it was forged. Right? Okay, now I want to make two more comments on this before I go into something deeper. Maimonides has a very interesting view on how rabbinic legislation becomes valid. He says the Sanhedrin cannot legislate new laws. It cannot do that. The Sanhedrin can only suggest new laws. The new law becomes valid only when the majority of Jews perform it. This is like direct democracy, where it requires a majority of Jews to actually carry it out. And if you don't carry it out, it's not binding. The law has not been has not become valid. And indeed, the Talmud has cases where the same law was instituted several times. Maimonides says that's because, in the earlier occasions, the Sanhedrin proclaimed it, and the people said no. And since they said no, it didn't become valid. On the final occasion, people said yes, and it became valid. So that it's only the Sanhedrin together with the people that will make it valid. Now, once it becomes valid, then it has to be to revoke it, which can happen. To revoke it, it requires the Sanhedrin to revoke it. Can't be that the people on their own will simply decide not to keep it. That's just mass violation of the law. But on the other hand, the Sanhedrin can't institute the law. It has to be carried out by the people. Now, the statement in the Talmud is this: Ein gozer in gzera tzibur elin kain rov tzibur yichodin la'amod bo. The strict translation of those words is: you don't make a decree on the congregation unless the majority of the congregation can fulfill it. Maimonides takes that with extra strictness. Not only can fulfill it, but does fulfill it. Or perhaps, how could you know whether they can fulfill it or not? What test could you possibly have that they can fulfill it? The only reasonable test is that they actually fulfill it. So if they don't, so in this way, it's not so much new laws being imposed from the top, but it is laws that are suggested from the top and accepted by at least the majority of the people. When one asks about the vast network of rabbinic laws, and one opines that maybe there's too much and so forth and so on, one should remember that it was accepted by the people, the majority of the people anyway, and not just imposed from above. That's one point. And the second point is, Luzzatto asks, if all these laws have divine authority, Mosaic authority, why didn't God communicate them himself? Why didn't God issue them himself? Why do you wait sometimes generations or centuries or even millennia for these laws to come into existence? Since they're going to have his authority anyhow. A non-answer would be, how could God stay them at Sinai when some of them are only relevant because of later circumstances that arose? Various events took place. You know, Purim, right? You celebrate Purim before the story takes place in Persia. Hanukkah, you celebrate Hanukkah before the Maccabees win their victory. It's ridiculous, right? That's not a good answer. Why is that not a good answer? No, but so the ones that are. It's not even good for the ones that are. Because God could have written the law as follows. If XYZ happens, then do ABC. He could have written the trigger condition into the law. And then when XYZ happens, then they'll do ABC. The fact that God makes a law doesn't mean it has to go into effect right away. Indeed, some of the laws that were given at Sinai didn't go into effect until they took over the land of Israel. So similarly, he could have given the instruction and have it take place 1,000 years later, have it take force 1,000 years later or 2,000 years later. That's not a good reason. Let me just tell you what the Ramchal's reason is and explain it. No, okay.
Wouldn't saying that isn't that kind of like how could you say that if he would have said this, if he would have said, you know, if you by any chance revoke the decree of the king in Persia 1,000 years later, then it's kind of telling the Jews what's going to happen in the future.
Right, but you could make it more general. You could say, if there is a salvation of such and such a type, write a text to make sure that that text is used as the performance of the yearly cycle, that you read it again and again. Now you could describe it in general terms. Don't say it's Persia. Don't say that it's Haman. Don't say that it's, that they bowed down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. Don't put all those details in, but describe it in qualitative terms. Well, it does actually.
In terms of like the Israeli laws, like it says in Torah, like you're going to go to Israel, so this is what you're going to do in Israel.
Right.
But that's because we already knew that we needed to go to Israel.
But it says more than that. It says to in the end of Deuteronomy, it says to Moses, this people will get up in the future and they will worship other gods, right? And then the consequence will be that they're going to go into exile. That's all written there. Yeah.
Don't we say that a lot of things are implied, within the text that we don't even aren't even capable of understanding?
Yeah, I think we spoke about that yesterday. In other words, that's like the 13 rules of Rabbi Shmuel.
That, even deeper than that. Like,
right. And someone asked about the Gaon of Vilna, and that the Gaon could get everything out of it. And I said, there are other rules that typically people don't know, and there are rules for taking things out. Okay. Now, this is the authority behind the rabbinic legislation. On Wednesday night, I'm going to talk about whether and how Jewish laws can change, and we'll talk about reasons for laws and reasons for laws changing. So I'm not going to do that now. I got distracted. Right. So the Ramchal's answer is this. It's really, I would say, almost a shocking answer. He says God didn't make these laws. He waited for the rabbinic authorities to make the laws because he wanted us to have a share in creating Torah. We should have a share in creating Torah. When I read that, I almost fell off my chair. That's a very daring concept. Hard enough to organize your life to keep Torah, right? To put it into practice. To create Torah? And then, on reflection, I thought to myself, let's consider the categories of holiness, categories of sanctity. What things, what types of things are there that have holiness in the world? Let's take the Temple Mount, city of Jerusalem, the land of Israel, geography. The truth is that we have the ability to expand all of those. There are procedures whereby we can expand them, and their sanctity and their rules will cover a larger portion of territory. Let's take the Jewish soul. The Jewish soul has a particular kind of sanctity. We can expand the category of the Jewish soul by accepting converts. And then there are more people with Jewish souls. So we have the ability to expand that. Things that are offered in the temple as sacrifices have a special sanctity. We create that sanctity. Walk up to a cow and say, you are a sacrifice. Bang, cow becomes a sacrifice. Right? Or oil, or wine, or flour. So we do have the capacity to expand that category as well. What about mitzvos? Can we expand the mitzvos? In a certain sense, we can. Anybody have a clue how we can expand mitzvos in a certain sense anyway? No, I mean biblically. So I'm looking for a source for the rabbinical ideas. Huh?
Doing it nicer.
No, expand brand new laws. Laws that didn't exist before I made them. How about a vow? I take a vow not to eat watercress. Well, watercress now is forbidden to me as pigs are. Because I made a vow. Taking a vow or an oath, which is two different mechanisms, is a way of creating new either prohibitions or obligations, which then have biblical force because I made them. So the Torah itself has been built into it, this expandable area. Okay, there are certain limitations, but to a large extent, an expandable area where I can create new Torah norms. Once I realized, once I thought of all those categories, I thought to myself, okay, so what the Ramchal is saying, that the rabbis can make new commandments, it is still striking. It's still striking. Had he not said it, I never would have dreamt of saying such a thing. But at least it has echoes in other areas. Yeah. In the essay on fundamentals, Maamar al-Chorim, the last five pages. Now, those who are listening carefully, depends on how long you've been in yeshiva, whether you know how to listen carefully or not. This is my experience. I said over and over again that if there's a conflict between rabbinic law and Mosaic law, almost always the Mosaic law takes precedence. So what's the almost doing there? Well, it wasn't a throwaway. I don't get paid by the word, so I throw an extra word to get extra nickel. I say almost. I mean, there are exceptions. There are times when the rabbis can set up their law, and even if it costs the violation of a biblical law, Mosaic law, they can do that. Indeed, those of you who are associated with groups that keep the commandments are all aware of this. You're all aware because it happens quite regularly. What happens when Rosh Hashanah comes out on Shabbos? You don't blow the shofar. You don't blow it, period. Rosh Hashanah comes out on Shabbos. You're talking about the Yontif problem, the Buktzah. You don't blow it. How come? The Torah says, blow it. The Torah doesn't say not on Shabbos. I'm talking about the Yerushalmi now. I'm talking about the Bavli. So the reason is because maybe You'll carry the shofar in a public domain, which is forbidden on Shabbos, maybe. And therefore, the rabbi said, lest you come to carry it by mistake, don't carry it. Don't blow it. It's a definite, universal, biblical commandment, blow the shofar for everyone of the Jewish people, versus the possibility that a tiny minority might, in good faith and enthusiasm, inadvertently violate a Shabbos law. There's nothing in the structure of Jewish jurisprudence, nothing in the rules of Jewish law which says that the mere possibility of a tiny minority inadvertently violating Shabbos is more important than the whole nation blowing shofar. Nothing says that. The rabbi said, we don't want you to do it. Now the question is, how do they win in a case like that? How do they manage to make a law which then can stand up against a biblical law and take precedence? There's another case of Lulav, it's the same thing. Even the first day of Sukkot comes out of Shabbos, you don't take the Lulav. Nothing in the biblical statement about Lulav indicates that Shabbos is different from any other day. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman has a very interesting analysis of this relationship between the rabbinic law and the biblical law. There are two statements in the Torah that you have to follow the laws of the rabbis. One is the one that we saw. According to the teaching they teach you, and according to the judgment they judge you, shall you do. And it says, don't turn aside from what they tell you right or left. That's a continuation of the verse there, which we didn't read together. Don't turn aside from what they tell you right or left. In another place, the Torah says to operate al pi Torah sheyerucha. According to the Torah that they teach you, that's how you're supposed to operate in general. So, says Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, there's a positive commandment to do what the rabbis say, and there's a negative prohibition against violating what they say. Now, in Jewish law, positive commandments and negative prohibitions have different status, and they relate to one another in various ways. In particular, what would happen in general? This can happen in life, where laws conflict, where commandments conflict. They may not conflict in and of themselves, but I've maneuvered myself into a position where I can't do all the laws. Like a person is sick on Shabbos, he can't. If he keeps Shabbos, he's going to die. He's supposed to protect his life, can't do everything. What would happen if there are two Mosaic laws, both positive, do A and do B? And I can't do both. Sorry? Okay, but if they're both simple positive laws, then legally neither one is more important. That's why the question is raised. But it could be that one of them can be satisfied passively, and the other one can only be satisfied actively. How could that be? Imagine a positive law to a Kohen. Stay out of cemeteries. That's a positive law. It doesn't say don't go into cemeteries. It says stay out. On the other hand, there's a law of returning lost items. And there's that lost cow sitting in the cemetery. What is it doing in the cemetery? Who knows? They left the gate open. And this Kohen wanders by and he says, oh my gosh. What shall I do now? I mean, there's this lost cow, and I should return it to its owner, but it's the cemetery. I'm not allowed to go to the cemetery. Okay, I'm not giving you the exact details because the real cases are more complicated. But at any rate, there's a positive law to stay out of cemeteries, a positive law to return lost items. And he can't do both. So the rule is, don't act. Be passive. Be passive. That means he's fulfilling the law, stay out of cemeteries, and he's violating the law of returning lost objects. One way to appreciate it is that an active violation is much worse than a passive violation. And if he'll return the lost item, then he's going to actively violate the rule of staying out of cemeteries. And that's much worse. So, if you have two positive commandments, one can be fulfilled only actively. One can be fulfilled passively, and you can't do both. Sit on your hands. Twiddle your thumbs. Don't do anything. And let the first one pass you by, and don't and fulfill the second one you can fulfill passively. Okay? Now, imagine a case like this. The Torah says do A. Do A actively. Do A actively. The rabbis say, refrain from A. It's positive. They don't say don't do A, they say refrain from A. Positive. When the rabbis say refrain from A, they're just telling you to sit still. So now, I have this biblical commandment, do A. And I have the biblical commandment that says, listen to the rabbis. And they use that biblical commandment saying I should listen to them, and they proclaim, do nothing. So now I have one biblical commandment telling me to actively do A, another biblical commandment telling me to do nothing. When it's a conflict between those two biblical commandments, then the passive side wins, which in this case happens to be the rabbinic side. So the rabbis can use that biblical law to listen to them if what they say positively is to be passive. What they say positively is sit still and don't do anything. Sit still. If they say that, then they're going to win. If it's reversed, they won't win. If the Torah says positively, sit still, and the rabbis say, get up and do A, then they lose. There's a limit to their authority according to this. There's some things that they can legislate against other biblical laws and some things they can't because of the legislative power that the Torah itself gave them is in a particular form that gives them a certain amount of leverage and not more. That's why the general rule is, though some Rishonim disagree with this, but the general rule is that the rabbis can tell you to violate the Torah passively but not actively. They can tell you to sit still and let a mitzvah pass you by. But they can't tell you to get up and actively violate a mitzvah when the Torah tells you to remain passive. So this is just a little indication of the authority of the rabbis. I haven't exhausted it, but it means that when you see rabbinic law and you're worried about a conflict with the Mosaic law, you can't just assume that the Mosaic law will take precedence. Usually it will, but sometimes it will not. And as I told you, we'll get into changes in law on Wednesday night. Questions? No? Yeah.
I'm not sure if you plan on talking about this later, but there are lots of rabbinic decrees that don't seem very applicable nowadays.
That's exactly what we're going to talk about Wednesday night. There are rabbinic laws for which we know the reasons, because the rabbis told us, and those reasons don't seem to apply today. And the question is, what should be done about them, what can be done about them, what is done about them. It's a very, very interesting area, and we'll talk about it Wednesday night. Yeah.
What does Rochon Osman do with those two psukkons, and where does he reconcile them?
Which two psukkons?
He says, one pasuk says that you should operate according to the Torah, and the other one says, don't be a right or left from it.
There's no conflict between them. The same item, the same performance,
yeah,
has a positive and negative commandment attached to it. That's quite common. Returning lost objects, it says, return the lost object and don't leave it behind. Right? There's positive and negative applying to the same act.
What's he explaining?
No, he's just explaining the positive side. He's saying, how can the rabbi's statement take precedence over another biblical law? Answer, the other biblical law says, do something. The rabbis say, sit still. Now you have a conflict between two biblical laws. One says do, and the other says sit still. In a conflict between two biblical laws, one of which is active, one of which is passive, the higher rule says the resolution is remain passive. So when their law is remain passive, they win. But if you were to reverse it, then they wouldn't win. And that shows you the limit on what they can say.
Do we learn that out? It says don't violate, so that by being passive take precedence? Or don't be a right and left?
No, it isn't learned from either of those. And we're now talking only about the positive side, the fact that we are told positively to listen to them. So when they say sit still, there's a positive commandment to listen to them. And against it is another biblical positive commandment, blow shofar. And it's a conflict between those two. And then there's a super rule in Jewish law that when there's a conflict between two positive commandments, you resolve it by remaining passive. Okay.
Where does
Which one of the essays?